Sir Roger Penrose has cut a unique figure in the world of science for over six decades. A first-class mathematician, he's been a font of ideas in theoretical physics too, many of them controversial. Not interested in following convention or in blindly jumping on bandwagons, Penrose is very much an independent thinker, quite content to swim against the tide. He's perhaps most famous among physicists for his brilliant contributions to developing Einstein's theory of gravity, and for pioneering our modern understanding of black holes, partly in collaboration with his friend Stephen Hawking, who first learned several critically important mathematical techniques directly from Penrose. My name is Graham Farmlow, and I'm the author of The Universe Speaks in Numbers, which features quite a few experts who've contributed to both mathematics and physics, including Roger Penrose. He's been extremely helpful to me, not only giving me interviews, but also by checking my account of the renaissance of Einstein's theory of gravity in the 1950s and 60s, and of Roger's invention of the mathematical objects he named twisters. He sometimes calls them my babies. Last year, I went along to the sleekly designed Mathematical Institute at the University of Oxford, where Penrose has long been based. Now in his late 80s, he's still a lively, enthusiastic and urbane man. In the interview you're about to hear, he gives us many insights into his early career and into the path he took to becoming a kind of hybrid mathematician-physicist. He also describes how he got involved in modern gravity theory and his relationship with Stephen Hawking, briefly depicted in the entertaining Oscar-winning movie A Theory of Everything. As we shall hear, the movie doesn't always get its facts right. First, Penrose talked about his early career, beginning with his entry to university in the early 1950s.
Well, I took mathematics at University College London for my undergraduate work, and that meant pure and applied mathematics, because that's what mathematics was in England, not in all countries. And yeah, I concentrated, I think, most on the geometry, to some degree on the algebra. I got fascinated by Lagrange's equations. I thought they were amazing. But I didn't quite take off with regard to physics at that stage, or applied mathematics.
So what attracted you into cosmology, astrophysics?
Well, I would say a couple of things. Going way back to my father, when he showed me Saturn through a telescope, seeing it's really out there made a huge impression on me. My older brother Oliver had interested me in the physics, and he read to me the Gamow books. Mr. Tompkins in Wonderland,
yeah.
Mr. Tompkins explores the atom, and they made a big impression on me too. But anyway, that's a small point. It was mainly I went to Cambridge to do my graduate work, and while I was still an undergraduate, I can't remember whether it was the last year or the penultimate year, I heard a series of lectures on the radio given by Fred Hoyle. Now, those talks started off with sort of fairly local about the various planets and things, and he got further out. And finally, in that last talk, he talked about the steady state model. And in this talk, he talked about, well, these galaxies, you know, move faster and faster away from us. And at a certain point, they exceed the speed of light, and then they disappear and you can't see them anymore. Something like that, you see. And I didn't quite believe that, and I drew some pictures with light cones and things like that. And I, for some reason, was going up to Cambridge, and I was visiting my brother, Oliver, and we were having lunch in the Kingswood restaurant. And I was saying, well, I've been listening to these talks by Fred Hoyle, and he said this strange thing about the galaxies disappearing off the edge and so on. And so Oliver said to me, well, look, I don't really know about cosmology, but sitting on the table just over there is a good friend of mine, and he knows all about cosmology. That was Dennis Sharma.
Oh, my goodness.
So I sat down next to Dennis Sharma, and I explained him my problems about the galaxies.
You hadn't met him before?
I'd never met him before.
No. Grief.
And I think Dennis was quite impressed by me drawing these light cones and things like that, and the argument that somehow they would fade out rather than just turn off, you see. The impression that Fred had given on the talks, that as soon as they exceeded the speed of light, pong, they would be off, you see. But the fact that they would fade away and they'd still sort of be in view all the time. You just track back how your light cone intersects these things. I had a picture of the steady state model, which was pretty well what it looks like. And I think it must have impressed Dennis. He said, he'd go and check with Fred, you see. I don't quite know what happened with that. But then, either in a year and a half or a year, I actually went to Cambridge as a graduate student, and I was working on the Hodge.
The mathematician Hodge?
Yes.
Ah, right, so because he was supervisor for Michael Attia as
well. He was indeed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I should tell you, you see, there were four people, graduate students, in Hodge's group. Mm. One of them gave up very quickly. Mm-hmm. One of them stuck with it, and he did a decent thesis, and then decided to work in history of science or philosophy of science. That was Michael Hoskin.
Oh, yes, at Churchill College, Cambridge.
Yes, that's Michael Hoskin. Anyway, no, I haven't seen him for ages. Mm. But anyway, then at one point, there was a particular problem I started working on that Hodge had listed. He gave a list of problems, the only one I could more or less understand that I decided I'd look at, you see. Mm-hmm. And at one point, Hodge was saying he thought perhaps I was a little uncomfortable about what I was doing. Maybe I would like to sit in on the other graduate student there. So I did. I went and sat in on the supervision of the other chap, and I didn't understand a single word of what's going on. Mm. It was totally over my head, and I thought, my God, if they're all like this, what am I doing here? Of course, that was Michael Attia. Michael Attia was the fourth in the group.
Oh, my goodness. Now it's all clear.
Yes. So,
my goodness.
Yeah, I became good friends with Michael at that point.
Yeah.
So, and I learned a lot from him, clearly. But there were a lot of very good people there who I learned things from on the mathematics side. But it was Dennis who really introduced me to all that was going on in physics, not just the steady-state cosmology, which he was a great proponent of, but he knew everything that was going on. Mm. And he knew everything and more or less everybody as well. Mm. And apart from, you know, just firing people up, which he did, he was excellent at that. He was extremely good at getting people together who might be of use to each other scientifically.
Great teacher by the sound of it.
He was, yes. Mm. He was an excellent lecturer too, yes. And so I gained a lot from him. I remember we used to go, he would often want to go to see the plays at Stratford.
And so Shakespeare
plays. Mm-hmm. And he would drive me there with him. He would like to talk with me about all the about what was going on in physics. Mm. He seemed to get a lot of talking to me, and I got a lot out of him talking to him. It was certainly the case. And he used to drive his car at great speed. I think he had a Jaguar at that point, around these sort of roads going around the hills and at great speed. And you'd get thrown to the side of the car. He said, well, that's the action of the fixed stars, he would say. So that was his view of, you know, Marx's principle. So we kept discussing about things. Well, suppose you annihilated the stars one by one, and then the Earth would be our frame, and then you annihilate the Earth, and it's the car, you see. And so I began thinking about this. Well, suppose you got down to two particles. Suppose they're two electrons or something. Mm-hmm. How do they know which way they're spinning and so on? Mm-hmm. So this was basically the origin of spin networks. Mm-hmm. You take things down to their really basic levels and see how you could get your rotation frame and how does that make sense in relation to quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. So that was that. Mm-hmm. But I got an awful lot out of Dennis. It wasn't just that.
Do you think he regarded you as a mathematician, or do you think he just saw you as another student, not a specialist?
I think he had a broader understanding of that. Okay. I think he realized I had some kind of physical understanding. Mm. And He took me under his wing, absolutely did. And he was trying to convince me that I should give up my mathematics and to study cosmology instead. I said, well, look, a lot of things I really like and interested in this subject, so I'll finish off my thesis. Yeah. It wasn't as simple as just finishing my thesis. The story got more complicated in various ways. But then I eventually got back and went to Cambridge again, this time as a fellow. Mm-hmm. And there was a very interesting occasion when Dennis, explaining how he was good at getting people to get together, and he said that there was a talk being given in London by somebody who was going to talk about the Schwarzschild singularity. And this was a talk by David Finkelstein explaining how you use the coordinates that are now referred to as the Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, and you can get your way through the horizon, and it's not a singularity. Yeah. And I remember being very impressed by this. Two strands at this. One thing was that I talked afterwards to David about spin networks. And David also used to comment afterwards that we kind of swapped subjects at that point. Because he went on and did combinatorial physics.
Yeah.
And then I went on to general relativity, you see.
Three lecturers especially impressed Penrose when he was a graduate student.
First, the mathematical cosmologist Hermann Bondi. Second, the logician S.W.P. Steen. And finally, the theoretical physicist Paul Dirac. Penrose was especially fascinated by spinors, the mathematical object that appears in Dirac's most famous equation, which describes the way that an electron behaves using relativity and quantum mechanics. Committed though Penrose was to mathematics research, he was, as he put it, soon sucked into the relatively little explored world of Einstein's theory of gravity, otherwise known as the general theory of relativity. It was then undergoing a resurgence, led by the great American theoretician John Wheeler and his associates.
I was interested for a long time in general relativity, but my interest in it as something I might work on myself came with the spinners. And then I wrote this paper for Annals of Physics on spinners. But then you see that you were asking about black holes. I think I made various visits to Princeton. I went to Princeton after, I think, just 2 years of my fellowship, because Dennis said, well, you must go and work with Wheeler's group because his crazy ideas look like yours, more or less, in some respects.
That's quite a compliment.
And so I wrote a screed which I sent to Wheeler. I mean, I was putting down all sorts of crazy things I was thinking of, and I think Wheeler couldn't make head or tail of it, and he gave it to Charlie Misner to say, should we take this chap seriously? And Charlie Misner said, yes, take him. So I went to Princeton on this NATO fellowship, and I learned a lot of physics there, you see, because general relativity in England at the time was very much a mathematical activity. You were finding all sorts of funny solutions which may or may not have anything to do with the world. They were solutions of the Einstein equations, and you could play around with them and so on, but it was still mathematical play. But when in Princeton, it was a real physics community. And so I picked up a little bit of that. I wouldn't say how much, but I certainly picked up a bit of that. And Charlie Misner, I got a lot from. I remember the first day when I went there, Wheeler was introducing the people. He said, let me introduce you to Reggie and Dickie. And I thought, well, gosh, that's awfully, you know, chummy first names for somebody who was a little bit aloof and so on. And then, of course, I didn't realize Reggie was Tullio Reggie. And Dickie was Robert Dickie. But you were asking me about the black holes. That came about, I think, mainly because round about, it would have been 1962, there was this great thing about the quasars. Martin Schmidt had discovered the first quasar, and this was this thing which was looked like a sort of star superficially, but were two things which were sort of almost inconsistent. One was it had a huge redshift. Well, I say huge, I mean big for something that you could see and look like a star. A big redshift that you can take from the spectrum, and it varied within weeks, the brightness. It went up and down, within a week it could change. And if it could be changing within a week, it would have to be, I mean, from its distance and its brightness and how much energy was coming out, people thought, well, gosh, the rate of change of the brightness showed it couldn't be bigger than the solar system. Yet, there was this huge amount of energy being emitted. I remember huge numbers of people were excited about it. And there were arguments, like, is it the redshift? Is it a gravitational redshift? Is it really moving that fast away from us? Is it just a local velocity? I mean, it was not so clear for a while what was going on. But it did become clear that here was a huge source of energy in some way, which seemed to indicate you had something there which was comparable to its Schwarzschild radius. And this was a point Wheeler was making. So and then there were lectures given by people, I can't remember who, on the Oppenheimer-Snyder model of gravitational collapse to what we now call a black hole. And this was a dust cloud. And more or less at the same time as this was being discussed, and Wheeler was very interested in, you know, is this a general, is it just a special case? Everything's focused towards that middle point. Suppose it was swishing around and not being symmetrical, then stuff might miss each other and then come swirling out again. And what about the special dust which doesn't have any pressure? Maybe when it gets too close to itself, it'll push itself away. And how do you know this is representative at all? It wasn't clear. And it was even less clear because at that time there had been discussions about a paper by Lifshitz and Khalatnikov, who appeared to have proved that in the general case you did not get singularities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had a look at what their proof, and I thought, well, I didn't quite see how you're going to prove a thing using that kind of method. That's a sort of, you know, it's a more general statement. I didn't know. I mean, you could, maybe it's an indication. But I didn't know. Mm. And I began trying to think about it, and I went for walks in the woods and tried to imagine myself inside a black hole, and how could the singularities not sort of bounce back?
At Birkbeck College in London, Penrose had a breakthrough after talking with the English mathematical physicist Ivor Robinson, who'd been working with gravity theorists in the United States.
I was at Birkbeck College in London. That was where I was teaching. And Ivor Robinson had come to visit from Dallas, Texas, is where he... I mean, he's English, very much, from Liverpool, and with a very pronounced English accent, which they all loved in America. And he was a very good talker and a very interesting, fascinating fellow. Did some very interesting things in GR too. But anyway, we were talking away, I can't remember what exactly, and then we came to a cross street, and the conversation stopped at that point because we had to look out for the traffic. And then we got to the other side and it started again. Ivor telling me all his latest things and all that stuff. And then when Ivor had left, I had a strange feeling of elation. I couldn't think what that was about. So I went back and said, you know, is it what I had for breakfast? That doesn't make sense. No, did he receive a letter of any interest? No, nothing like that. I went through the day. And then I remembered crossing the street. I'd had this idea, which I then uncovered at that point, which I think was the idea of a trapped surface.
Mm-hmm.
See, I wanted a criterion which doesn't depend on your collapse being symmetrical anyway, to a sort of topological thing, which, you know, you perturb it a little bit and the condition still holds.
Mm-hmm.
And it holds inside the Schwarzschild horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And this was this notion of a trapped surface. You have a closed two-surface, space-like two-surface, and the null normals, those are the null directions which are normal to it. And I realized this was a criterion that would probably enable me to prove what I wanted. So I went back to my office after Ivor left, and I pretty well sketched out a proof that this gave a singularity, that you couldn't avoid it. The argument was a little uncomfortable in one part. I think it was in the autumn of 64 when I was talking to Ivor. Don't remember exactly when. I wrote the thing up, sent it to PhysRev Letters. It was published in 65. I remember giving a lecture about it at King's College, and I was very proud to see that a great distinguished physicist there, not as the film say, Stephen Hawking, it was J.L. Singh.
Oh,
mm-hmm. And I gave this talk about the singularities must be there. And I was a little bit disappointed by the argument because it only showed the singularities in the middle and it didn't give you any feeling for what you could see outside.
Right.
But anyway, I think Singh was impressed enough. According to the movie, Stephen was there with this talk and sparks coming out of his head or whatever it was because he was being...
He wasn't there. Oh, dear.
But it's not quite as bad as you might think because Dennis Sharma heard about the lecture and he said, well, you must come and give a repeat up at Cambridge.
Ah.
So I did give one at Cambridge. Yeah. I was in London at Birkbeck at this time, but I gave the talk in King's. And I went up to Cambridge in 65, and Stephen was there, and I talked privately to Stephen and George Ellis afterwards and explained the details of how you did all this stuff, and so that Stephen was able to pick up on the general lines of argument from that.
Because he was Dennis's student as well, wasn't he?
He was, that's right.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay.
I can't remember quite what George Ellis's role, maybe it was just at the same college of Stephen.
Well, you were one of the examiners of Stephen for
PhD,
weren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, that's right.
Were you in the movie?
There was a gentleman in the movie who's with my name, yes.
Right, okay. I've forgotten whether you were.
Okay. But it was a bit peculiar because the actual viva for Stephen's thesis was not like anything would happen in actuality. Oh. First of all, because there were three examiners, Dennis Sharma, myself, those were correct, we were.
Yeah.
And Kip Thorne, where did he come from? I don't know, they just thought he'd like to put him in the movie, I suppose.
Oh, so he wasn't there? But
no. He wouldn't have.
Well, he'd probably advise it. He probably was advisor to the movie or something.
Oh, he might have advised the movie. I have no idea.
That would have been quite a threesome, but yeah.
No, Kip Thorne was certainly not there. Mm-hmm. No question about it. Mm-hmm. And there were certain errors in the thesis, which I was, you know, going to point them out in the Viva and point them out. But Stephen had already noticed them. Mm-hmm. He had to correct these, but he did this by just putting lines through the wrong results and then resubmitted the thesis.
Did, really?
So, but I was told, yes, George Ellis was looking at his thesis, and he told me that he just scribbled out the things that were that were wrong, and what was left seemed to be, or maybe he wrote something in handwriting above it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what he wrote then was all right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Unquestionably, he did good work, and he developed these ideas in ways that I hadn't done. I'm never quite sure whether it told you any, much more than we knew already. See, I mean, I always felt that with the black hole singularities. And if you have a collapsing universe with all sorts of irregular complications, the singularities that you get in the black holes must be there. But it's not sort of a rigorous theorem so much. Mm-hmm. So he worked out these other results, which were very impressive, impressive.
The contributions to our understanding of black holes made in the 1960s by Roger Penrose and Stephen Hawking, in collaboration and separately, became legendary. It was not until the late 1970s that astronomers became truly convinced that black holes do indeed exist, though they could not produce a clear image of one that they could show to hardcore skeptics, including the authorities who administer the Physics Nobel Prize in Stockholm. The Swedes usually won't award their prize to a theorist until they have watertight confirmation of his or her conjectures. In April 2019, the Event Horizon Telescope at last gave us the first ever images of a black hole. As so often happens, objects and phenomena show up in the real world decades after theoreticians conceived them and even speculated about them in detail using physical principles and precisely formulated mathematics. It's surely now time that Penrose is awarded a well-deserved Nobel Prize, perhaps shared with the fellow pioneer Roy Kerr. The late Stephen Hawking should also be given an honourable mention. Roger Penrose continues to work hard, developing his twister theory and thinking deeply about the application of mathematics to fundamental physics. He's a vocal critic of many modern ideas in physics, notably string theory and the concept of the multiverse. He sets out his objections to these and other aspects of modern mathematical physics in his popular book, Fashion, Faith and Fantasy, a challenging but rewarding read. Roger's views illustrate that fundamental physics, like every branch of science, always has distinguished naysayers. This is just as well, as it keeps informed debate flourishing and keeps younger practitioners on their toes. Although the universe is speaking to us in data and mathematics, it's rare to find unanimous agreement on what it's telling us.